In Poland, these controversial moves of the government and the debates, to me, look very much like a repetition of very similar moves by Hungarian Viktor Orban. But there are some differences, and generally, those departure from liberal democracy are enormously varied. And political scientists, social scientists, coined even a name for the democracies which start to depart from some aspects of liberal democracies, illiberal democracies. Illiberal democracies which have elections, they might have also electoral competition, they might have representative bodies, but some aspects of liberties, constitutional rights are ignored, waived, or weakened. And there are many types. To paraphrase the famous first sentence from Tolstoy, Anna Karenina, why liberal democracies are all similar to each other. The illiberal democracies are illiberal, each in its specific way. And those departures vary from restraining, constraining, paralyzing the highest courts, from constraining democratic reflection of public views, civil society, to various forms of intimidation of the opposition. Russia is not a democracy. Russia departed from democracy in all fronts. When? Well, it's difficult to judge because democracy, liberal democracy, includes so many factors. Rule of law, free expression, as well as parliamentary representation of all views, all people, plural representation. It's very difficult to say at what point Putin took Russia away from democracy, but there is an agreement that by 2005 to 2008, Russia ceased to be listed by various international agencies as a democratic society. Not Hungary. In Hungary, it happened a different way, and perhaps it's worth spending a few minutes to highlight the difference. First, Orban and Kaczyński. Jarosław Kaczyński is the leader of the Polish victorious party Law and Justice, which is sometimes referred by its acronym PIS, P-I-S. They are different in many respects. Orban is a Calvinist. Jarosław Kaczyński in Poland is a Roman Catholic. Orban loves Putin. Kaczyński hates Putin and accuses him of plotting to kill his twin brother in the plane crash in 2010. Orban, and this is a very important difference, opposes any form of political moves which might result in economic sanctions towards Russia. Kaczyński sees Russia as a major danger in Europe. But above all, Orban, in 2010 election in Hungary, gained a constitutional majority. It's very important. Because as I mentioned previously, constitutions are not cast in iron. They evolve, they change. But they change by the book. And in Hungary, in Poland, constitutional change, especially the role of courts and tribunals, as well as the operation of politics, requires two-thirds majority on the floor of parliament, as well as majority in the Senate, upper house, with minimum 50% presence, as well as confirmatory public plebiscites, which approve. And Orban did his changes to the constitution with parliamentary majority and by the book. They were liberal changes. Nevertheless, neither European Union nor Council of Europe nor American friends and allies could in any way intervene because he did it partly by the book. I say partly by the book because there are big debates what constitute breaches and what doesn't constitute breaches. It's very important because many people think that Poland has been treated very badly by EU, European Council, Americans, while Hungary got away with similar changes. There are important differences. I'm not Urban, Viktor Orban's big friends. Nevertheless, in a fairness, one may say that his sins were much more obvious. While these sort of introductory rules took me a lot of time, I'll make my main comments about the causes and consequences very, very short. Why this illiberal turn in Poland? The sociological explanation points to two particular constituencies which were mobilized by law and justice during the presidential and during the parliamentary elections in Poland. They are both very anti-liberal social categories, and the way of appealing to those groups created this syndrome of liberalism being, if not attacked, at least seriously eroded. During the presidential elections in May-June 2015, the candidates of the Law and Justice Party made appeals which got him a support of a youthful group which I would like to call precariat, young people who experience very high unemployment and experience very bad labor market conditions. And that points to the dark sides of the Polish transformation. That although it was successful in providing growing income, at the same time, it alienated the whole generation of young people who experienced not only general unemployment, but catastrophic youth unemployment in Poland. The red line shows the level of youth unemployment. Remember, in the first 4 years under mostly left-wing SLD government in Poland, in spite of the very rapid economic growth of economy functioning very, very well, over 40% of young people couldn't find a job. That was catastrophic. The consequence of it was not only the alienation of young people from society, which did not provide them opportunities to start their life, but also alienation from the left. The left evaporated in Poland, never regained public trust, because young people remembered, and young people are, so to speak, natural constituents of left of center parties. They felt betrayed by the left, ceased voting left, and wiped out the parties of the left from the political spectrum. And they experienced a rebound of youth unemployment, not only after the Great Recession, as it is called in Europe. Poland avoided mercifully the worst ravages of this 2009 Great Recession. But the rebound coincided also with the spread of the so-called unsecured labor contract. In Poland, they are known as rubbish contracts. śmieciowe kontrakty, which did not provide people with social security, which gave them only salaries. People from China would not, because the same happens in China. Many people have terrible labor contracts, leaving them in insecurity, hence the name precariat, refers to the sense of insecurity, precarious life. The safety valve in Poland was, of course, migration. Nearly 3 million young Poles migrated all over Europe. The fastest and more frequent, most frequent moves were around 2000 and between 2004 and 2008. And they had less to do with the political party and government at that time, and more to do with the opening of the European markets. Just before the 2008 great crisis, economies in Europe were hungry for young workers, and Polish young people experiences unemployment and rubbish contracts at home, moved en masse to Britain, France, Germany, Belgium, forming a huge migrant labor force there. And they also voted very strongly against the Civic Union, PO, government in 2015. They voted against the establishment, which they associated with the deprivation of their precarious life. The most successful political leader who mobilized these young people against the establishment was Paweł Kukiz, a very new political leader who entered the presidential contest and managed to get 20% of vote, predominantly from young, unskilled people who were feeling left behind and who were left behind in Poland. It was angry political vote, vote of protest, anti-establishment. Kukiz wooed the sentiments of those young people by attacking the establishment as corrupt and unresponsive to social needs. But they also were attracted to the law and justice candidate, Mr. Duda, who presented a similar message. Poland is in ruins. You are the main victims. So he wooed them. And in the second round, decisive round of election, where only two candidates were competing, 60% of Kukiz's voice moved to Duda. Kukiz is a product of popular culture more than politics. He is a punk rocker whose songs are after those corrupt powers that be and politicians. But he doesn't provide any solutions. Unfortunately, he is one of those extreme snake oil sellers like Beppe Grillo in Italy, like Pauline Hanson in Australia. Very right-wing in his policies and pointing to all sorts of conspiracies. Recently, he accused the pro-democratic protesters of being on the pay of Jewish financiers. And he recognized the extreme right and left because they are moving to the conspiracy theories. The left has its kulaks, the right has its Jewish financiers. They are standard targets of mobilization. And second electorate, who also was deeply illiberal, revolutionary, were the old people, religious, attending church regularly, without skills, who also felt left behind, but not so much by the Polish economy as for Polish culture. They were alienated culturally. they felt that the liberal secular culture coming to Poland via media from the West is not their country culture, that they are marginalized in this culture. The evidence, if you look at the differentiating variables in elections, they provide the best evidence that those electorates were crucial for the victory of law and justice. In presidential election, the most important differentiating variable, that is the characteristic of peoples who voted for the law and justice candidates, was the low age, young people with low skill and low education. Okay? These were the important audience. People who felt the losers left behind. In the parliamentary election, it was the attendance of the church. Among people who attended the church at least once a week, 62% voted for law and justice. And the average vote was slightly below 38%. So great disproportion indicating the effective political mobilization of those audiences, audiences which include people with low education, low level of skills, and also who were very frequent church attenders. I think I should conclude by saying, what are the consequences of such illiberal mobilization? Obviously, illiberal policies. The mobilization means that the government elected by such specific groups is obliged to pursue policies which those groups favor, which are not liberal, and which break this return to Europe consensus and create a very deep rift. The rift within elites, which makes the pursuit of politics in this liberal, regulated way extremely difficult. And it's also associated with terrible acrimony. People call each other traitors. The debate between the two sides is poisoned by toxic passions, as James Madison used to call them. Passions which are incompatible with politics understood as rivalry, as competition. But it, when it appears, it's associated with politics as a fight and struggle, in which many constitutional fine points, the right of people to presumption of innocence, except when sentenced, when found guilty by courts, very often widened, a victim of this acrimonious debate. If Poland is moving towards Hungary, south, it also should look at the performance of Hungary. This role model is not very good. The Hungarian policy, strongly nationalistic, strongly illiberal, strongly accused of dictatorial bends, do not point in the same direction as return to Europe, the European consensus. Hungary is also doing badly economically. It had recessions not only in 2009, but also 2012, and Poland now exceeded the GDP per person of Hungary in its national wealth. So it's not a very optimistic conclusion, but I'd like to return to my first sentence in conclusion. Namely, that democracy is in danger, in real danger, when people don't care. When people do care, when people discuss it, when they consider people with different views as their rivals not end, democracy is still in a relatively good shape. And this worry about democracy in Poland is above all the positive factor in my perception of the overall state of democracy in Poland. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Pakulski, and now we have Professor Martin Krieger, who will have been given a license to carry on the discussion.
Thank you very much, John. As advertised, I'm a rule of law guy, and I will say something about that. Jan has given you a magisterial survey of what has happened, an argument about why it's happened, and a pessimistic, almost completely, but not wholly pessimistic, projection of the potential consequences of that. I do endorse all of it. I don't have anything in terms of detail to add to it. Perhaps I should stop here, but I won't, because I'd like to deepen a couple of implications, or at least delve into a couple of implications of terms which featured a lot in Jan's talk, in particular liberal democracy and illiberal democracy. Institutions in settled political systems have a logic. They're not just a random grab bag, a bit of this, a bit of a court here, a party there. There is a logic. If you want liberal democracy, certain functions will need to be satisfactorily fulfilled. If you want illiberal democracy, which is not simply the absence of liberal, it is another game, it's another architecture, then you will look at institutions in a different way. In liberal democracy, you have to simplify greatly and embarrassingly, because if I'm a rule of law guy, this is the democracy guy. Nevertheless, I'm here, I have to keep talking. In liberal democracy, for it to function successfully, you need at least two jobs to be done. One is the governors, you have to have a system for choosing governors. And the second is you have to have a system or institutions for taming the powerful, which centrally includes governors, but not only governors. Now, we use elections to choose governments, and they're good at that. They do something to tame governments as well, but they do it rather weakly and wholesale. They can't get into the details, they can't get into day-by-day affairs. They happen rarely every 4 years in Poland. So if you're interested in taming, in containing power, then you have to look at what John has extensively written about monitoring institutions. Institutions which, if elections are horizontal in their, if you want to characterize them, you would think of institutions of horizontal accountability. Other governmental institutions like courts, like an independent prosecutor, non-governmental institutions like the press, social institutions like a strong civil society. You need all of that stuff to be in good shape for your democracy to be in good shape, because if you don't have the second lot of institutions, you have a tendency and a danger of at least three things. Monopoly of power, the people who have the power have all the power, and that's dangerous for very obvious reasons. The famous English liberal of the 19th century talked about the tendency of power to corrupt and absolute power to corrupt absolutely. He didn't invent the notion, people had noticed it before. Secondly, wild and arbitrary power are terrible things. Everybody who knows something about Eastern Europe, but you don't only have to know about Eastern Europe, knows that people there over generations, centuries, have been victims of wild and arbitrary power, and it's a terrible, terrible way to live. So you want to try to institutionalize some way to constrain, to make that not a routine possibility. And thirdly, you want to avoid stupid power. Governments which don't have to defend themselves, which don't have to provide reasons, suddenly run out of reasons. They do what the governing body wants them to do, and suddenly they don't have to defend themselves, they don't have to worry if they've made a mistake, they're unlikely to worry if they've made a mistake. So, as John has written in his splendid book, since he plugged me so nicely, I'll plug him in turn, but he deserves it, on the life and death of democracy, democracy is a powerful remedy for insolence. Its purpose is to stop people getting screwed. That's a technical political science term. We can understand. Okay, so you need these two sorts of institutions for these jobs to be done. No one, is my second point, is complaining that in Poland there was something wrong with the elections. The elections were held, they were fair, they were free, and PiS, in league with Kukiz's party, won a majority fairly, and they are entitled to govern. The problem is at the second horizontal level. This government has been in power not quite 4 months. In that period, as Jan has told us, there has been the extraordinary, sustained, and unconstitutional attack on the Constitutional Court. There has been renovation of media law to make the public media, the chiefs of them sackable, they have been sacked, and replaceable under the direction of the government, the Treasury. There have been amendments to the civil service law to allow the top echelon to be appointed by the government, not according to meritocratic
criteria.
What's the thing? English is a problem. The independence of the prosecutor has been eliminated. The government's chief head kicker, Zbigniew Ziobro, will become the chief prosecutor. That is again unprecedented. Not unprecedented.
In Austria, is the same.
Sorry.
In Austria, is the same.
No, it's not. The prosecutor is a separate office in Australia.
Oh, no.
But I'm glad you interrupted, but I hope you don't do it too often, because my point here is not that there is one institutional foible or another institutional foible, but what we are looking at is something which is a systematic assault on institutions, an assault which seeks to degrade them in one of two ways, either by capture, they become ours, not mine, but ours, or by subversion, which is what is happening with the Constitutional Court, which was no longer going to be able, for the foreseeable future, even to decide issues on constitutional challenges to the government. Now, Jan has talked about illiberal democracy. In July 2014, Viktor Orban, of whom we've heard a bit, proudly said, Hungary is an illiberal state, but he didn't invent the concept. A Pakistani-American journalist, Farid Zakaria, wrote an article in 1997 where he took the surprise of a lot of readers in coined this term, illiberal democracy. He said, look, we've been fighting for democracy, democracy for a century. Now we've got democracies all over the place. Democracy, he said, is flourishing, but liberalism is not flourishing. Because this second order of institutions in Belarus and Hungary and maybe threatened in Poland is subverted by people who are happy to get votes and can engineer to get votes, particularly if they can novel the media independent institutions, etc., but are not happy to share power with institutions which can ask them questions, to which there can be appeal, which can review their decisions, which can publicise, criticise, and so on. Now, it's not just a matter of particular difference of ideology. There is an enormous difference of ideology between PiS and between PO and other parties. What I'm talking about is something which distresses me a great deal, and it's not a matter of particulars. It is a matter of a lack of a sense or a hostility to institutions per se, unless there are institutions. So if you attack the head of the Constitutional Court as a person, you are ignoring that he's also a member, he's the head of the Constitutional Court. If you attack all sorts of offices by simply saying that their people are corrupt and are going to be got rid of, if you have the former head of your anti-corruption commission, who was found in a court of law a few months ago to be guilty of various offences and sentenced to 3 years in jail, and you then, the first thing you do is appoint him to be head of
but
the
it's
police.
Not true. You're missing the point.
But,
I'm sorry. I can't listen to you.
I'm sure I'm missing every point, but one point is stability of discussion. I'm trying to stick to that. What happened, the court decision, maybe it is reviewable, and the court decision may be false. For all I know, and there are some allegations of this, the court decision may even have been corrupt. It's not the job of a government to say, well, I don't care about the appeal. I don't wait for the review. I simply appoint.
You see, correct. Correct what you are saying. Correct.
Now, stability is an important concept to which I'll come, and I'd like to hear some of it, maybe less of its opposite, as I come to my conclusion.
Completely wrong.
One of the indexes of that of institutional sense or hostility to institutional sense is the presence of the leader, the most powerful man in Poland himself, Mr. Kaczynski. Because he was such a controversial figure, he did not run for president. A young, attractive man was brought to run for president. A lot of the popular talk was this was a different piece. This was a more civilized, more attractive person. This was not the man who leads to hostilities, who calls his opponents the worst sort of power. He's a different figure. Then, when the parliamentary elections a few months later came, the party was led by, and the party that was won, was led by another public non-entity, Bartaszyn. As soon as the elections were over, it was evident to everybody there was one man in Poland running the show, Kaczynski. He has not been elected to that position. He has none of the constraints of that position. He meets with Orban for a six-hour meeting. The Prime Minister is not invited to that. The President is not invited to that. Now, that may be wonderful. They're nice guys. I'm sure they enjoy each other's company. But it is a complete rejection of the significance of institutions. This is an insistence on the personalization of rules. And when rules are personalized to that extent, then the notion, the difficult harmony, orchestration of a liberal democracy where a lot of things have to play off against each other, and you can't rely on having all the right people in office, so you rely on the offices, all of this comes under threat. Two more things and to conclude. It's not a peace innovation. It's common in Eastern Europe and it's common in Poland. But peace accelerated it with single-minded determination and ruthlessness. And that is the sense of a politicized institutions. There's no sense, there nor was there under communism, that there needs to be some independent roots and integrity of institutions, rather it's ours or theirs. Okay, we've got it, so we need this. And that drives a great deal of the changes that we've been talking about. Let me conclude with one last reflection, which is both historical, autobiographical, and present-oriented. It's all those things, so we have another hour, I'll be talking. Young mentioned, and it's a wonderful phrase I hadn't heard, the notion of toxic passions. I wrote a book called Civil Passions, which John mentioned, largely inspired by my romantic attachment to the Poland of the 80s, to the birth of, to the utilization of the notion of civil society, to the birth of a notion that there were us who trusted each other against them, and we didn't trust, us being the society, them being the polity. I wrote about that at some time and said, look, this is lovely, and I love this side of it, but it's unsustainable, because the only thing which makes us one, unity, is the sense of an opponent. Now, I thought that this was a good opponent to have, so I applauded it, but I worried about what the future would be. I hoped that when, as would inevitably happen, the unity against communism disintegrated, it would disintegrate into patterns based on interest and ideology supported by institutions, civil society organizations, able to interact. And here was a peace word. Civil interactions, where my rival is not my enemy, where the parliament doesn't hear people in a country where these words have weight, not like in Australia, where people are accused of treason. No one, Mr. Shorten doesn't accuse Mr. Turnbull of treason, but if he did, we would think, what's going on here? The word doesn't have the weight here, which it has in a country where treason has been a very, very serious word, a very serious fact of life. So when this happened, toxic passions come to rule when they are inflamed, as I believe they have been inflamed, by the present governing power, it seems to me something tragic to the spirit of the country is occurring. And quite apart from the institutional, perhaps boring things, but I'm a lawyer, I'm allowed to be boring, that I began by talking about, this spiritual degradation seems to me very, very, a very great thing.
It's that such are the 19th century wirings in this room. You may know that it's a room of great historical importance, and you've probably been looking at the graffiti, or graffiti which is carved into the desk. So my job is to appeal to you, please, to your best civil passions. Let's have a good debate. Let's not interrupt. Let's listen to each other. And because we don't have a roving mic, my job is faithfully to translate the question.